Welcome back to Speaking of Mysteries. I'm sorry that we are a little late getting episode 5, which features April Smith and Stephen J. Schwartz, and is the third in our series of interviews recorded at the Los Angeles Times Festival of Books, published. But Les Klinger and I were otherwise occupied in New York at the Edgar Awards. They were, in a word, fabulous. There are lots of awards in the genre recognizing the overabundance of talent, as they should. But the Edgars are the granddaddy of them all for American awards. In the best novel category, there were lots of familiar names. Thomas H. Cook, Matt Haig, Louise Penny, Ian Rankin, and Laurie Roy. But it was William Kent Kruger who won the bust of Edgar Allan Poe for his Ordinary Grace. I paid special attention to the best first novel by an American author category, because I'm always looking for new writers to add to my reading list. I had read 4 of the 5 nominees: The Resurrectionist by Matthew Gwynn, Ghost Man by Roger Hobbs, Rage Against the Dying by Becky Masterman, and Reconstructing Amelia by Kimberly McCrate. Wouldn't you know it, it was Red Sparrow by Jason Matthews, the only one I hadn't read, who won. I finished it on the plane ride home to Los Angeles. I honestly have no idea how the judges made a call. All of those novels in that category are spectacular. Matthew Gwynn's second novel was due out early this summer, and Les and I plan to have him come and chat with us at Speaking of Mysteries about his second book. In our first interview of this podcast, Les Klinger chats with April Smith. April's latest is not a FBI Special Agent Anna Gray mystery, but rather a standalone titled A Star for Mrs. Blake, about a little-known United States program that sent White Star mothers who had lost sons in World War I to Europe in the 30s in order to make pilgrimages to their sons' graves.
This is Les Klinger with April Smith. We're here at the LA Times Festival of Books. And April, welcome to Speaking of Mystery.
Lovely to be here. Thanks, Les.
So your new book is not a mystery, or not really fully a mystery.
Well, mysterious things happen, you know, on board this boat. A Star for Mrs. Blake is the title, and it refers to the Gold Star Mothers' pilgrimages to France in 1931 in order to see the graves of their sons who were killed in World War I. But it's not a historical venture. Things happen on the boat and afterwards, and there's a death and a secret and a scandal. And it's been a wild trip writing it. It took 25 years to do it, but I was compelled to write it, and I'm glad that it's out there now.
Well, and it sounds like a historical mystery, sort of. So how did the mystery writing background for you inform this book? Was this different? Was it very similar in experience?
Well, it's completely different because you are dealing with facts that need to be verified. And the truth is that this was an overlooked footnote in history. So it's news, actually, to most people, that the Gold Star, first of all, is emblematic of a loss of a family member in the military. It's the official United States Congress recognized symbol, and only certain family members can wear the Gold Star. And so in the 30s, during the Depression, the United States recognized the sacrifice of women in war by funding pilgrimages to Europe, and about 7,000 women went on these journeys, and nobody knows about it. Nobody remembers it. So that was the mission. In terms of mystery writing, you know, you're telling us a compelling story and you still want to keep the reader turning the pages. So there's a lot of suspense and unexpected plot twists in the book.
That's very exciting. So are you eager to get back to Anna?
Well, I was going to write another Anna right before I got sidetracked by this one. So, yes, I'm going to write another Anna. Absolutely. Anna's on the way.
Oh, good, because your readers are going to be anxious to hear that, I'm sure.
I know. I know.
So tell us a little more about Anna. Tell us sort of where you see the series going? I mean, obviously, I'm not asking for any great revelations, but you know, where is the series going? Where's Anna going? She's gotten a little older. Has she got a long career ahead of her still? Or is she going to retire one of these days?
Well, I don't know how long her career is going to go, but I can tell you that she's ripe to move up in the ranks in the Bureau. I think she's ready for a supervisory position, as opposed to always fighting those battles from, you know, underneath authority. I think she's going to have authority. And then we'll see what she does with it and the new challenges that will arise from having all that responsibility. But she's ready. She's paid her dues.
You've put this series out at what I would call a deliberate pace. You've never been a one book a year writer, which is refreshing. We can actually savor the stuff. So is that intentional, or has that been just too many other things on your plate?
Well, it's not intentional. I mean, I know it's ideal. Mystery readers are the greatest readers in the world, and they want and deserve, you know, new stuff as fast as possible. But in my case, since I also write for television, there were many opportunities that I could not pass up, you know, like doing adaptations of Stephen King's work and Anna Quinlan's work. Yeah, I mean, you know, shooting a miniseries on Stephen King's, based on Stephen King short stories in Australia, is something that doesn't come along every day, so you grab it. You know, I mean, it's a moving target, staying employed as a writer, as you know.
Well, yes, I understand. I have a day job. Your day job is writing, but it's a different kind of writing. Talking, I wanted to ask a question about the festival. So you've been coming for a long time, and why? What's it do for you? What's it mean to you?
Well, because I need more mugs is really why I come.
They are so beautiful.
They are, and, you know, they last for about 2 months before they completely fade out. So every year you have to get a new one.
Absolutely.
That's the only reason.
Okay, well, that's fair. That's fair.
Yeah.
I get it. And I was talking to somebody earlier today, and I said, you know, it's the food in the green room.
Well, that too. Although Lee Goldberg tasted the chocolate cake. I have a picture of him on my website, I mean, on my Facebook page, tasting a chocolate cake and pronouncing it okay.
Great. Great.
So,
well,
here's breaking news for you.
Okay. Well, so we really appreciate your coming on the show. We've just started this series of podcasts, and we've been trying to talk to prominent authors, and you are not only prominent, you are here. So
we
really appreciate it, April. Thanks for being with us, and we'll talk to you again when the next Anna book comes out. That would be great.
That would be great. Well, it's a beautiful day, so enjoy the festival.
Next is Stephen J. Schwartz, who has to have one of mystery fiction's most interesting characters in his up-to-now two-book series, Boulevard and Beat, LAPD Detective Hayden Glass. Stephen's third novel is not a Hayden Glass mystery, however. It's a standalone called Triple X, featuring a young FBI agent charged with bringing a fugitive back from Amsterdam. And while he doesn't have the same demons as Hayden Glass, he does have his own compelling backstory. I apologize for the ambient noise during the interview. It was recorded at the height of the festival, when readers were mobbing the Mystery Inc. booth looking for titles from their favorite writers. I know that in time, Les and I will get better with the technology that permits us to edit these recordings. I thank you for bearing with us in the meantime. Here's Stephen J. Schwartz with Les and me. Welcome back to the Los Angeles Times Festival of Books from, where are we, Les?
The Mystery Inc. Bookstore.
Mystery Inc. Bookstore Outpost, and we're here with Stephen J. Schwartz, a mystery writer and...
Yes, good morning, good afternoon, good to be here. amazing.
Thank you. And we were going to ask you about your series of three books.
There's two books now, and there will be a third in the Hayden Glass series. But right now I'm working on a standalone, which is an FBI thriller set in Amsterdam.
So I take it it's an overseas agent.
He's actually a young FBI agent in the U.S. Who has to go to Amsterdam to bring back a felon who's responsible for a series of murders, which includes this man's wife, and he's just going to escort him back to the U.S. But when he gets there and he apprehends this felon, the guy gets loose in Amsterdam. So the whole book takes place in Amsterdam.
So this sounds like it came out of a desire to travel to Amsterdam.
I did. I went to Amsterdam to do some research.
And then you said, well, while I'm here, I might as well make it research.
Exactly. Yeah, just for tax purposes.
Right, of course. Yeah, we understand. I'm a tax lawyer. We understand that. So Hayden Glass will be back, though.
Hayden Glass will be back. Originally, this was going to be a Hayden Glass novel. How this began was my agent said, you should take Hayden Glass international. Send him to Bangkok or something.
Especially right? Amsterdam. It fits his personality.
My agent said, send to Bangkok. And I said, well, everyone I know is writing about Bangkok. I said, Hayden Glass likes the tall blonde, so he'd probably go to Amsterdam. So that's where I went. I wrote a proposal for Hayden Glass in Amsterdam, but my agent said, write also a standalone proposal that you can do separately in case you want to go that direction. And ultimately, I wanted to do a standalone, and it was a better story having this young American lost in Amsterdam. And what it ends up becoming really is it's like the spy who came in from the cold meets 310 to Yuma. 310 to Yuma. So it's kind of like, it's this sense of the young agent dispels the myths of the FBI. He thinks he's doing the right thing, but he's really being manipulated into the pawn. And at the same time, he's trying to get this guy back and get into the U.S. Embassy in The Hague before time runs out. Ticking the clock.
It was interesting that you mentioned when the film is done.
Yeah.
You're also a screenwriter. So could you talk about the difference between putting together a novel
as a writer, you don't have much of an opportunity to put together a film. You write your screenplay, and it's an outline for a director's vision, basically. So screenwriters are not ever that happy with the process because they're never the author of their work. A novelist is the author of his work. He's the screenwriter, the director, the producer, the cinematographer, everything. And when he writes a book and sends it out in the world, he gets feedback directly from the readers. It's a phenomenal experience. Most of my friends who are screenwriters who become novelists are very happy being novelists. When you write a screenplay, it's basically your vision, and then you hand it off. And if you're lucky, it gets picked up by a producer, and then a director is attached. And then most likely, you'll never see it again. And even if it's produced, there may have been three, four, five other writers that have been attached to rewrite that work before it's ever produced. And then it's a director. Ultimately. So you may see a film that you've written and you'll never recognize a scene in it.
What about going the other way for people that have written books that have been optioned as films? They always seem to be very diplomatic by saying, I'm going to leave it to the screenwriters. They're the architects of bringing something like this to fruition, to life.
Yeah.
Is that true?
It is the best way to handle it as an author. There's an old saying that if you're an author, you drive your novel to the border of Arizona and California, you throw your novel on the other side and you take off the other direction. It's not in your hands. And the film industry prefers that. They'll hire a screenwriter to take the adaptation. They usually don't trust the author to do the adaptation because if an author has never written screenplays, they don't know what it's like to pull all that stuff out of the novel and create. Novels are 300, 400, 500 pages, right? The screenplay is 110 pages. You have to bring everything down to a central theme, core theme, and things get cut out. Characters get combined to become one character. These are things that are very difficult for the original author often to make those very difficult decisions.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So the screenwriter does that, and if you get a good team, a good director, a good screenwriter, they can do a phenomenal job of adapting the novel. I've had enough experience in screenwriting that I would love to adapt my own work, but at the same time, if I were to attach myself as a screenwriter, I would be doing myself a disservice because I might be able to get a major.
Would limit the market?
Yeah, absolutely.
So,
you know, it's become almost a rule now that in the mystery genre we had, for many years we had almost superheroic detectives, but now the detective has to have feet of clay. Feet of clay. They have to be somebody that the reader can relate to as a human being with flaws. Now, your character has got an unusual set of flaws. How did that come about, and where has it taken you that you didn't want to go, or that you were happy it taking you?
It's been good to explore a character. We've read a lot of characters who are police officers that are alcoholics, let's say.
Yes.
Or, and then it became kind of drug addicts and cocaine addicts and meth addicts, whatever. But I'd never seen a hero character struggling with a sex addiction. And sex addiction is a really, a lot of people don't even believe it exists. I've had experience with sex addiction. It was something that I was struggling with. And this was, in a sense, a catharsis for me and an opportunity to really explore it and put it on the page in a realistic manner where I know you've seen the movie called Thanks for Sharing. Thank You for Sharing.
Good,
that's probably
good,
one of the best films about sexual addiction that I've ever seen. Really take it seriously, and you see where the problems are. So I wanted to have a character struggling with that. It ruined his marriage. You know, it caused a divorce. He goes to meetings, goes to 12-step meetings. He has a sponsor. He's doing everything he can to be straight, but
sometimes
when he gets nervous, when he gets anxious, when there's a lot of tension in his life, he'll go to strip club, he'll pick up a prostitute, things like this, and then he'll lose his time, and he has to build his time back up just as an alcoholic would, or a drug addict, and that's his process. So it's kind of interesting to be able to go into those rooms with him and see this police officer struggling with those kinds of, you know, things.
So how's the...
That's always a showstopper.
I don't know how to come back from that.
That gives me a platform to talk about.
Your FBI agent, does he have feet of clay?
He has his own issues, definitely. And I've given him a backstory where he was the cause for his parents' arrest.
Yes.
They were doing something illegal, and he set them up in a sense.
Right.
And then he joined the FBI later, and he's struggling with the guilt from having ruined his own family, really. And he has to become a man in a way, and the guy who's kind of giving him the instruction on becoming a man ends up being, you know, this killer that he's out chasing. So it's a lot of complex, interesting things that want going on, and he has, and he cuts himself too. So that's he's a cutter. Yeah, and you don't often see that in a man. So I wanted to kind of explore that a bit too. Wants to hurt himself.
What's the name of the book?
It's called Triple X, because that's the flag from Amsterdam.
I love your hands.
Three X. So it has some double entendre.
And it'll bring in those people who think it's another story about Hayden Glass.
Which would have been perfect for a Hayden Glass novel, it's Triple X. But,
So you've been a regular at the festival for many years. Why? What's the festival all about for you?
Take care. Thank you very much.
Why do you come?
This is my favorite time of the year. I love it. There's so much energy here. There's so many great books. I love going to panels.
Oh,
I always try to catch as many panels as I can. I love seeing all the other authors, friends of mine that are authors, people who I knew as readers who are now authors. They've got their first book published. Now they're on panels. I'm moderating. This year I was moderating with Stuart Woods and Peter James and Michael Florian and Ken Goldstein.
So Stuart and
Peter have been or will be on the show.
Oh, good. So it's so fun to stay involved in the world of writing, to see people, you know, obsessed with books as I am obsessed with books, it's my one time of the year that I come here from the morning to the evening. They have to kick me and my family out every year. We're the last ones to leave this campus. We're here for both days and all the parties, and I bring my kids, and my kids have been coming here since they were a little small. Everyone's seen them grow up now. Yeah, so I love it.
Yes,
it's a great event, and a lot of people don't realize it is the largest book festival in the United States.
So there. So that's what we've got in Los Angeles.
We really appreciate you coming on the show, Stephen. It's been fun to talk about sex.
Hey, you can't be talking about sex. I'm going to send you to a meeting, my friend.
Thank you.
But Nancy, Les, thank you so much for having me on. I love it.
Our pleasure. Thank you.
You bet.
Our next episode will include interviews with T. Jefferson Parker and Daryl James. And next Tuesday afternoon, I'm interviewing Joe Nesbo. I know from previous interviews that he doesn't like the question, "So tell me about your book." So I'll do my best not to ask that specific query about The Sun, Joe's about-to-be-released standalone. If you have any questions you'd like me to ask Joe Nesbo, other than tell me about the book, please let me know through either our Facebook page or our website, speakingofmysteries.com. Thank you.